Chapter 7. Cold Cuts and Hot Feet. My Life in the Clubhouse. In 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson initiated a series of social reform programs he dubbed the Great Society. One of these involved providing assistance and funds to help disabled people purchase a home. As soon as I realized that I wanted to be a homeowner, I submitted my application. As with many government programs, there are lots and lots of hoops and red tape that you have to get through before actually reaching that goal. I was very close to the end of the process in 1971, when one last roadblock appeared. This one would be almost impossible to surmount without assistance. Luckily, I'd made a few influential friends at the ballpark. Presidents Kennedy and Johnson were in office just as my baseball career began. They very rarely got to games, so I never met them. Over the years, however, I did have the opportunity to chat with several of the men who occupied the White House. President George H.W. Bush was captain of the Yale baseball team in the 1940s. He was a big baseball fan and often went to ball games. I was in the National League clubhouse at the All-Star Game in Toronto in 1991, when the Secret Service came in, unannounced, to clear the room of everyone but the players and coaches. I was headed out the door with a crowd when National League President Bill White, Mr. Rizzuto's longtime on-air partner with the Yankees, grabbed me and said, "Not you, Ed." A moment later, President Bush walked in with former Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau. White introduced me to both men. Mr. Bush shook my hand and called me an inspiration to all baseball fans. One of the players stuck a ball in my other hand and urged me to get Bush to autograph it. I reluctantly asked him, and he complied. It was only later in the press box that my guide told me that the president had signed the ball in green ink for some odd reason. His son, George W. Bush, was managing general partner of the Texas Rangers before he won the presidency in 2000. The younger Bush actually traveled to Yankee Stadium with the Rangers on several occasions. I was in the hallway outside Mr. Steinbrenner's office one night in the early 1990s, when W. stopped to ask me what I thought of the Rangers' roster that season. We immediately hit it off. When he returned to Yankee Stadium as president to throw out the first pitch at the 2001 World Series, shortly after the September 11 attacks, I couldn't get near him to talk. But he waved and nodded in my direction as we passed in the tunnels below the stadium. President Clinton moved to New York after his term of office in Washington was done. He spent a lot of time at both Yankee Stadium and Shea Stadium, so I ran into him quite often. Clinton wasn't a historian of the sport, like the Bushes, but he could hold his own. What struck me most about him was his boisterous laugh. Also, as others have said of him, President Clinton made me feel like I was the only person in the world he wanted to talk to at that moment. But the commander-in-chief whom I got to know best was Richard Nixon. In between the time that he lost to John F. Kennedy in the 1960 presidential election and the time he came back to win it all in 1968, Richard Nixon moved to New York City to practice law. He was also a big baseball fan. During those years, Nixon became a fixture at Yankee Stadium. His usual spot at the games was in the owner's box, just a few feet away from where I sat. We would often talk baseball, and he knew his stuff. After his presidency ended, Mr. Nixon would travel from his home in Upper Saddle River, New Jersey, to attend Yankee games. One of the greatest moments I ever experienced was when President Nixon tapped me on the shoulder in the middle of an inning. I stood up, took my headphones off, and stopped listening to the game. "Excuse me, Ed," Nixon said. "I don't mean to interrupt the game for you, but I just finished reading your article about Yogi Berra and had to tell you at once how much I enjoyed it. You and Yogi gave me some pretty good laughs just now." The article that the president was referring to was in that month's Yankee Scorecard magazine. I'd written a column in that issue about the time that Yogi and I stood around the batting cage talking about rookie players. I happened to mention to him that one of the youngsters could hit, throw, and catch skillfully with both hands. Berra's response to me was, "Man, oh man, I'd give my right arm to be ambidextrous." That was typical Yogi. Gene Meehl happened to be my guide that day that President Nixon approached me. In a hasty attempt to capture the moment, Gene reached into his inside jacket pocket for his camera. Before he knew it, three Secret Service agents moved him away from me and the president. They wanted to be sure that it was only a camera that he was going to shoot us with. Gene never got his picture. When our conversation was over, I shook President Nixon's hand and proudly said, "Thank you, sir. It's an honor to get a compliment like that from you." He continued, "I always look forward to your articles, Ed. Keep them coming. If there's anything you ever need, just let me know." I appreciated the offer, intending never to have to call him for help unless it was completely necessary. It turned out that I did. By the time my application for Lyndon Johnson's mortgage assistance program for the disabled had gotten to the approval stage in 1971, President Nixon had been president for 2 years. New administrations often try to put their stamp on the country by rolling back or reshaping their predecessors' programs. And this is exactly what happened under Nixon. He and Congress put a freeze on many of the great society funds. I wasn't too worried. My application had been submitted long before the reverses were enacted, so I was told I was grandfathered in. The funds were supposed to be guaranteed for me. Knowing that, I'd already made a bid on a house on the west side of Jersey City. The clerk in charge of approving my loan, however, wasn't so certain. I was at work on the afternoon of Monday, May 3rd, when I received a call from a man at the Federal Office Building in Newark, New Jersey. He was phoning to let me know that I couldn't have the loan from the government due to the Nixon rollbacks. I calmly explained my grandfather clause to him. Still, he wouldn't budge. We went back and forth for over an hour, discussing the fine points of government programs. Both of us felt strongly that we were right. My frustration was leading to anger when I decided to put a succinct end to the debate. "What's the bottom line here?" I said. "I only have a few days to complete my bid on this house, and I don't want to lose it. What would it take to get this loan approved?" I could hear the sarcasm and self-satisfied snark dripping from the other end of the line, as the clerk smugly replied, "The only way you're going to get the money from this, Mr. Lucas, is if the President of the United States himself calls me and tells me that it's okay." I broke into a huge grin that he couldn't see from his side of the call. "Thank you very much." I hung up the receiver to disconnect. A second later, I picked it up and dialed the White House. The next morning, as I was getting ready for work, our doorbell rang repeatedly. I asked who it was at such an early hour. I recognized the nervous voice at the other side of the door right away. It was my telephone debate partner from the day before. A phone call wouldn't do. This clerk drove all the way from Newark to personally hand me papers with presidential approval for a loan in whatever amount I needed. He said very little to me, with the exception of humble apologies that continued from the time that he walked up the front steps to our apartment until he got back to his car. Dee and I were now the proud owners of our very own home. We closed the deal on Friday, May 14th, and moved in on the following Monday. It wasn't a mansion, but it was just enough for us. The house was on Nunda Avenue, which is a dead-end street that borders a large county park. It was perfect for the boys to explore and play. There were 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and 2 levels. The bus stopped just up the street, so my commute was made a lot easier. One of the other things I wanted to do for Dee now that she was back home was to get her a car. With a little help from Mr. Cusick, double shifts at work, and other small sacrifices, we were able to buy a family-sized station wagon. I also paid for Dee to take driving lessons. One night, shortly after we moved in, Eddie called me into his room. It was long past his bedtime, but he was full of energy. He wanted me to read a few pages from his favorite Disney storybook. This is a rite of passage that almost all parents share as their children grow up. I desperately wanted to experience it, too, but I was prevented by my limitations. I offered to recite a fairy tale for Eddie from memory, but he was insistent. He wanted to read the book along with his father. I was trying to come up with another way to satisfy him when Dee burst into the room to find out why there was such a commotion. Eddie said, "I want Daddy to read me a story, and he doesn't want to." Dee said, "He's blind. He can't read it. Your father will never be able to read books to you." I was sure that she didn't mean any harm with her remark, but I was crushed. Around the same time, I began to notice that Kay was slowing down. Dogs usually have a 10 to 12-year lifespan, which is great for the families that love them. Even when they naturally start to age and lose vision or mobility, pets are usually allowed to live out their days curling up quietly at their master's feet. For seeing-eye dogs, it's quite different. As working dogs, they are subjected to the same chronological limitations as athletes. 35 or 40 is considered young in human years, but baseball players see their skills deteriorate so fast at that age that even the best choose to gracefully retire. Seeing-eye dogs at a comparable age in dog years can't climb steps or move at the same pace as their master, making them no longer fit to work. This heartbreaking realization came to me when Kay couldn't repeat even simple tasks that she'd done thousands of times. I had to make the tough decision to retire her and to take on a new partner. I called the seeing eye. Our house was too small to be able to keep Kay and a new dog, even if I wanted to. They suggested that I bring her back to happily live out her retirement years on their farm with another owner. I went back to the seeing eye for my second dog. Eddie and Chris were still too young to feel the loss like most kids would, but Kay was more than my pet. She was an extension of me. I wondered if I'd be able to welcome and adapt to a new partner. Would the heartache end? 3 weeks later, I left the seeing eye with my new dog, Flo. She was a black Labrador. Flo moved at a different pace. Kay would stop on a dime at street corners. Flo would reduce speed as she approached the same corners. Flo was noticeably slower. Their training was exactly the same. But all dogs, like humans, have different personalities and styles. I had no choice but to adjust to her. Months after Flo came to live with us, I was still slipping up and calling her Kay. I loved my new dog, but felt the loss of my partner over a decade, and it made me feel sad. To cheer me up, several friends and family members came over to meet Flo and to bring housewarming gifts for her, Dee, and the boys. I'd already been blessed in my life with a great gift, a sense of humor. I used it as a way to get through dark moments. My visitors knew this, so we spent hours trading punchlines, laughing long into the evening. It was just the tonic I needed. One of the people who was most supportive during that time was also, without a doubt, the funniest man I've ever met. Jerry Malloy was the living definition of the cheery Irishman, always ready with a joke. He was a Hudson County legend, not only for his encyclopedic memory of great comic lines, but also for his role as a baseball and basketball coach for three different local teams. Jerry held the New Jersey record for wins with over 1,000 at each school. The guy was tireless. He had such a great sense of humor that Jerry was an extremely popular after-dinner speaker. Eventually, New Jersey named him Toastmaster General, an honorary post that took him all over the state entertaining crowds. Jerry definitely knew how to make me and everyone else who crossed his path laugh. He also encouraged me to develop my own banquet speech, one that would highlight my life in baseball and all that I had accomplished since my accident. To give me first-hand experience, Jerry would take me along with him to speaking engagements. We traveled to breakfasts, luncheons, and dinners from Cape May to Mahwa. I was learning from the master, filling my repertoire with jokes for all occasions to help round out my presentation. We usually wound up back in Jerry's hometown of Hoboken after we were done. He would bring me to a social club to hang out with his best friends, Dolly and Marty, who just also happened to be the parents of my favorite singer, Frank Sinatra. One night, we came home extremely late from a dinner in Central Jersey. Jerry was the MC. He spent hours after the affair ended, chatting with admirers and giving advice about speaking. By the time we got back to Jersey City, it was pitch dark. Jerry drove down my block, pulled up to the house, and began walking me to the front steps. I knew right away that something was amiss. My house had steps leading down. This staircase was going up. I stopped Jerry and said, "This is wrong." He asked me how I could possibly know that if I couldn't see where we were. He insisted that I was mistaken. When I explained, Jerry took out a match and read aloud the number on the mailbox. I started laughing. Jerry, that's three numbers away from my house. I'm telling you, this isn't the right place. He sheepishly agreed. When he finally brought me to my steps, I turned around and asked, "Would you like me to drive you home too, Jerry?" A few months after that, Jerry was booked to speak at the Knights of Columbus pancake breakfast in Camden. It was about 100 miles south of Jersey City. There was no such thing as satellite GPS then. Jerry was hopelessly lost. After driving around in circles, we finally pulled up to a banquet hall. But Jerry still wasn't sure if it was the correct location. He left the car running, got out, and said, "Stay here, Ed. I'm going to head inside and see if it's the KFC breakfast. If it is, I'll come right back for you." 45 minutes later, I heard him shouting, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Ed," as he dashed in a panic toward the car. When Jerry had entered the hall to see if he was in the right place, they immediately escorted him to the dais, because it was his turn to speak. Jerry was so flustered that he completely forgot about me. Three-quarters of the way into his talk, he stopped mid-joke and screamed, "Holy smokes! I've got to get back to the parking lot!" We both used that story in our speeches for years. I wasn't going to the ballpark much, because I'd made my promises to Dee. I missed baseball, but the respite came at the right time. The Yankees were in an uncharacteristically horrible slump. After decades of being the gold standard in sports, the team had fallen hard. The farm system was decimated, legends like Mickey Mantle had retired without suitable replacements, and the league had expanded. From 1965 to 1972, the Bronx Bombers wound up at or close to the bottom of the standings. This was bad for fans, but even worse for freelance writers and broadcasters like me, who covered the team. The formerly hapless Mets were now the toast of the town. I still hadn't made many connections with the Mets, so I didn't enjoy as much access with them as I did with the Yankees. Nobody was buying stories about the Yankees unless they involved scandals or slinging mud, and that just wasn't my style. Nevertheless, I nurtured my love for the game in other ways. My son Eddie was now old enough to be able to play baseball in the backyard with me. My father bought Eddie a kid-size wiffle ball and bat for his fifth birthday. As soon as the first nice weekend came along, Eddie begged me to go outside and play with Grandpa's gift. I couldn't wait. Dee had gone out shopping with Chris to get him new shoes that day, so it was just me and Eddie alone in the backyard. We used the house as a backstop. I set Eddie up at a makeshift home plate. I walked a few feet away and told him to say something so I'd know in which direction to throw the soft plastic wiffle ball. After more than a few tries, Eddie connected. My son got his first hit. Other than the cries of Eddie and Chris when they were born, this was the sweetest sound I'd heard in years. We spent the next 30 minutes or so repeating the routine. I would pitch the ball, Eddie would swing. If he hit it, the trajectory was so slow that it would only take me a minute to find the ball. If he missed, the ball would bounce off the house and roll back to me. Either way, we were able to play this father-son game without interruption. Then Eddie suggested that we switch sides. I agreed, but told him that he would have to let me know when he was throwing the ball so I could take a guess and swing at it. He lovingly replied, with that endearing logic that little children often possess, "No, Daddy, you don't understand. We're switching places. Now I'll be the blind one, and you can see." I hugged him and continued our game, filled with mixed emotions over his innocent request. A few days before that, I'd had a conversation with a fellow graduate of the New York Institute for the Blind named Barbara. As we caught up on old times, Barbara told me that her son, like Eddie, had asked her to read stories to him at bedtime. She shared the same frustration that I did. Barbara was thrilled that she'd found a company called Twin Vision for the Blind in Tarzana, California, that provided books for blind parents to read along with their children. Twin Vision was founded by a sighted woman, Jean Norris, in 1959. She'd heard a blind parent at a meeting express the same concern that Barbara and I had. Norris, who was adept at Braille, took action. She transcribed several books into Braille, with a printed version and illustrations on one side of the page and the raised dots on the other. They were an immediate hit. Within a few years, she was shipping thousands of these Braille children's books for free to blind parents and youngsters all over the United States. Barbara had been using the Twin Vision service for a while. She was very happy with them. I signed up for it. The night the first book, Pinocchio, arrived, I sat down on the edge of Eddie's bed and read it side by side with him. As happened with a little puppet in the story, a transformation occurred. A whole new world had opened up for both of us. To Eddie, I wasn't his blind father. I was just Dad. There were no more strings on me. Eddie's little brother, Chris, was being teased by the other kids in first grade a few years later. They were telling him that their fathers could do things that I couldn't do. Chris shut them all up at once by saying, "Oh, yeah? Well, I bet that your dad doesn't have special powers like my dad does. He can read to us in the dark." Twin Vision had turned me into a superhero. My wife didn't share that view. Delilah got a phone call in May of 1972 that brought her to tears. I could hear her crying from the other room, so I rushed over to console her. My first thought was that something terrible had happened to her mother back in Europe. Dee's explanation stunned me. She said, "It's not my mother. It's my little sister, Eva." That was shocking. Eva was 4 years younger than Delilah and had just moved out to California to look for work. I asked, "Is your sister okay? Did she get hurt?" "No," Dee sobbed. "She's getting married." Now I was really confused. I thought wedding announcements were supposed to be happy news. When it came to my wife and her sisters, they weren't. Dee's siblings always had a competitive streak. Each one had to outdo the other. Only one of them still lived in Jersey City like we did. Her sister Stella married a county employee, had several children, and was very happy staying put. She was often treated like a black sheep in the family. For the other sisters, life in America had to be onward and upward. I asked Dee why she wasn't happy for her sister. "Happy?" she screamed. "Do you know what her fiancé did to celebrate? He took her to Chez Madeleine, the most expensive restaurant in Fresno. It's $100 a plate. Then they got on a plane for Hawaii for a 2-week vacation." I still didn't understand why this wasn't cause for joy. I reminded Dee that we've been pretty blessed ourselves lately, with a new job, the house, the car, the boys. "You call all of this a blessing?" she said, getting more agitated than I'd ever seen her in a while. "I'm cooking hot dogs and taking my sons to the swings on the playground, while my baby sister is eating at 5-star restaurants and flying to Maui. Where's the blessing in that?" Delilah stormed off into our room and slammed the door. I wanted to give her some space, so I slept on a cot in a room with our sons. The next day, when I arrived home from work, Dee was waiting outside. It was a Friday afternoon, so I thought that she might want to go out to dinner. She had other plans. Dee put the handle of a heavy suitcase in my hand and said, "Feel this." I knew what it was, but not why it was there. Her next words hit with a thud. "I'm leaving." I was thrown off balance as I replied, "Leaving what?" She shot back with, "You. I'm leaving you. I can't do this anymore." I stood there silently for about 10 minutes, too stunned to respond. Finally, I broke the silence by asking Dee why she was leaving and how long she'd be gone this time. "This isn't like Texas," she said. "I'm leaving forever. I'm not coming back. This marriage is in no way what I pictured it would be. I need to go somewhere to find myself." In a combination of confusion and defensiveness, I fired back. "Find yourself? What is that supposed to mean? Whatever is wrong, we can work together to make things right." Delilah sighed and said, "That's just it, Ed. I don't want it to be work anymore. Marriage should be easy. Everything should be simple. My sisters don't have to do much, and everything is taken care of for them. I want that, too, and it's clear I'm never going to have that with you." At that moment,
one thing became shockingly clear to me. No matter how much talking or reasoning I did, there would be no convincing Dee to change her mind. My marriage, like my heart, was shattered irreparably. Once I let that reality sink in, I turned to the most important matter of all, my boys. Luckily, Eddie and Chris were with my parents at a zoo in New York City for the day and didn't witness any of this. "What about our sons?" I asked. The sound of her voice was as cold and emotionless as I'd ever heard. "You can keep them." I wanted to be sure I was hearing her right, so I asked again. "You're leaving me and them? You'll come to see them on weekends or something, right?" The silence that followed from her told me all that I needed to know. "I can't take them with me," said Dee. "I want to travel and to discover that kind of person I should be. I want to explore that alone. The boys would just get in the way." The last remark really upset me. "Get in the way?" I was shouting now. "These are your children. You're just going to leave them without saying goodbye? What should I tell them?" "You're a writer," Dee said. "Make up something creative." Suddenly, incredible sympathy for what my wife must have been going through welled up inside me. I couldn't imagine anything that might haunt her so much that it would push her to just give up and leave everything that she loved behind, especially her children. She must have been in deep torment. Before I had a chance to ask her to stay long enough to see her sons, a cab pulled up. Dee rushed into it with her bags, telling the driver to take off as fast as he could. That was the last we saw or heard from her for almost a year. In April 1973, Dee got in touch with George Francanero, who was then acting as my lawyer, to let him know that she was officially filing for divorce with the state of New Jersey and annulment with the church. She would give up her rights to the house and grant me full custody of the boys. She never even bothered to show up for the hearings in court. 4 weeks later, Dee married a guy named Bert, whom she'd met the previous November. He was a Yugoslavian immigrant who owned a chain of successful butcher shops in New York and New Jersey. They bought a big house in the suburbs and had 8 children together over the next decade. I was sad to see my marriage end, but I wasn't bitter. I wished Delilah, who was going by her middle name, Beverly, well into her new life. Occasionally, she would call to ask for Eddie and Chris to come and visit her. I never said no to her requests. My sister Maureen and her husband Jimmy moved into the house on Nunda Avenue with us to help out. Their son Jeffrey was born just a few months after Chris, so he and the boys became like brothers. We converted one of the rooms on the lower level into a bedroom for me, and Maureen took the master room. It was a perfect living arrangement. For the first time in a long time, we had peace and calm. More than a few friends made the joke that I was now free to go on blind dates. I laughed heartily along with them. Once again, God's gift of humor was my lifeboat in rough waters. Still, something important was missing. I kept hearing the siren call of baseball. Perhaps it was just the voice of Scooter, who left few broadcasts go by without asking, "Where's that Huckleberry Lucas tonight?" The time was right to head back to Yankee Stadium. Jackie Farrell reached out to me after the divorce to see if I needed anything. He also invited me to come over to the Bronx to meet one of the new owners of the Yankees, a shipping magnate from Cleveland named George M. Steinbrenner III. Mr. Steinbrenner put together a group that bought the team on what happened to be my 34th birthday, January 3, 1973. He promised to be a silent owner. But that didn't last long. After seeing how badly neglected the Yankees and their ballpark had been by their previous owners, CBS, he took action. The old guard of reporters mocked George for his plans to rehabilitate Yankee Stadium and the team. These were the same guys who had ostracized me a few years earlier. For many of them, this was their parting shot. They were close to retirement age. A new wave of broadcasters was taking their place, and I felt more at home with this crowd. Many of them, like Warner Wolf, Sal Marciano, Chris Berman, John Miller, Bob Uecker, and Al Michaels, welcomed me warmly when I came back to the press box. George Steinbrenner joined the group that greeted me. In our very first meeting, I was surprised that he asked me how I was doing, and even how my boys were. Jackie Farrell and Mr. Rizzuto had told him my story a few weeks earlier, and the new boss showed genuine concern for me. I was astounded. Before he left, George said, "Eddie, you are part of the Yankees family now. I expect to see you in that seat almost every game." Who was I to disagree with him? My seat actually moved a few New York interborough bridges over in 1974. George decided to give Yankee Stadium a facelift after 50 years. So the team had to move to Shea Stadium in Queens for two seasons. They shared it with the Mets. Luckily, I'd already had a guided tour of the new ballpark, provided by one of its biggest heroes. Outfielder Ron Swoboda saved the World Series for the Mets in 1969 with a miraculous catch in Game 4. That made him an instant Mets legend. I had gotten to know him a few years earlier when he was a rookie. I once interviewed him for my radio show about his feelings on breaking into the majors. He stopped mid-chat to turn the tables and to ask me a question. Swoboda wanted to know how I lost my sight. When I told him about my boyhood accident, he followed by asking me if anyone had ever taken me around a major league ballpark to describe it up close. I said, no. I spent the next 45 minutes walking with Ron as he helped me better visualize Shea Stadium by running my hand along the outfield wall, touching the bases, and traveling the length of the warning track. This would come in very handy now that the Yankees were playing there. A renewed winning mentality was instilled in the Yankees under George Steinbrenner. Shortstop Gene Michael, catcher Thurman Munson, and outfielder Bobby Mercer were three of the Yankees who really embraced it, helping to build the team back up. I was lucky enough to develop close relationships with all of them. They made it much easier for me to do my job, paving the way for me to be accepted as just one of the guys in the clubhouse. Gene Michael was known as Stick, not for his prowess with a wooden bat, but for his tall and lanky frame. Though he wasn't the biggest star on the team, Michael was definitely the shrewdest. Gene was a master at the hidden ball trick, which he demonstrated for me several times during interviews. He was usually the first player to greet me when I came into the clubhouse. When his playing career ended, Stick became a Yankee for life, holding every job imaginable with the team, coach, manager, GM, scout, executive, everything except for peanut vendor. Thurman was a bit more complicated. He was Rookie of the Year when he came up with the Yankees and was the leader of the team, on his way to becoming captain. Thurm could be mercurial and wasn't a fan of the media. He rarely granted interviews. For some reason, he and I had a pretty easygoing relationship right from the start. Munson knew that I was a reporter, but didn't mind talking to me. I was able to tell what mood he was in as soon as I walked in the door. I gave him room on days that he wasn't up for conversation. Thurman liked that. He told other players on the Yankees and around the league that I was a guy they could trust. I appreciated that. Thurman and I developed a mutual respect. Bobby Mercer was, like Mickey Mantle, a kind-hearted and talented Oklahoma boy. He took over Mantle's position as the Yankees' primary slugger. He also treated me just as well as his predecessor had. Mercer's sense of humor was amazing. I can't recall a day that went by without the two of us joking with each other before and after games. Bobby had something unusual at his locker stall. He placed an old-fashioned rocking chair in front of it. He would sit there, conducting interviews as he rocked back and forth. Mercer claimed that the soothing motion helped him to recover from the various aches and pains that came from playing baseball. It definitely set him apart. One evening, I was talking to Bobby about the two outstanding defensive plays he'd made in that night's game. He spent 10 minutes giving me some great quotes. 5 minutes in, I noticed that something was different. Mercer was standing up. I commented on it. Bobby said that the rocking chair had developed a small crack, which he repaired. He wasn't sitting on it, allowing the glue to dry properly. As I was putting my tape recorder away, I said, "Thanks for the interview, Bobby. I have to say, though, this is the first time I've ever spoken to a player who actually admitted to being off his rocker." Unfortunately for Mercer, the move to cavernous Shea Stadium in 1974 hurt his home run swing. He hit only two dingers that year, way down from his average of over 25 a season. The Yankees traded him to San Francisco in 1975 for another hard-hitting Bobby. His replacement became one of my closest friends in baseball. Bobby Bonds only played for one season with the Yankees. It was a memorable one. He hit 32 home runs in 1975, stole 30 bases, and scored almost 100 runs. He was one of the first of George Steinbrenner's big player acquisitions. He came up in 1968 with the Giants and was a protege of Willie Mays. So I got to know him even before he arrived in New York. Like Thurman, Bobby didn't really trust the media. Nevertheless, he always took the time to talk to me. I wanted to know his feelings about the game. Bobby was fascinated with the details of my life as a blind reporter. It was a two-way street. The thing that really caught Bobby's attention was my ability to tell where the ball was going just by the sound of the crack of the bat. Every day at batting practice, Bobby would call out, "Eddie, do your thing." I then predict with about 99% accuracy where the ball was going to land. Players and fellow broadcasters would gather around to watch. Over the years, people have asked me to describe what it sounds like to hear a ball hit and to know instantly where it's going. It's an innate sense that comes naturally to me, so it's hard to put into words, just like it would be hard for you to describe what salty tastes like without using that exact term. The closest analogy to my unique method of following a game would be the echolocation that bats use in caves. They hear sounds bounce back to them, enabling them to tell where they are and where they are headed. The volume and pitch of a baseball bat making contact tells me all I need to know as it rings throughout the ballpark. To my sensitive ears, a long home run sounds like a cannon being fired. A weak fly ball reminds me of a champagne cork popping, and an infield hit is reminiscent of twigs snapping underfoot. The direction is just a matter of listening for the echo. I've always been able to tell the difference without fail. At the end of the 1975 season, Bobby finally found a way to stump me. I stood by the batting cage feeling as confident as ever with my sonic feet. Bonds grabbed me in a bear hug and said, "You're never wrong about what goes on at the plate, are you, Eddie?" I agreed with him. "Okay, smart guy," he said as he chuckled. "Let's try this. The next player who gets up, tell me whether he's black, white, or Hispanic." That was one trick I couldn't pull off. During the summer, Bobby would occasionally bring his 10-year-old son, Barry, to the ballpark. Like other players' kids, Barry would sit in the clubhouse while his dad was on the field. He would also play pickup ball games with other children in the hallway, outside the locker room, as Bobby did interviews. Barry was a great kid, very respectful and courteous. Bobby raised him well. Like his dad, Barry was curious to know more about my blindness. Bobby would sometimes ask me to look after his son when he had to go upstairs to talk to the boss, or to do a national TV interview in the studio. To pass the time, I'd hand Barry my Braille watch. He loved it. Barry and I started a great relationship that lasted throughout his own stellar 21-year career in the 1990s and 2000s with the Pirates and Giants. And, of course, my boys traveled with me to the ballpark whenever they weren't in school. Chris loved television, radio, and movies, so he'd sit with the camera operators, engineers, and producers, learning how a broadcast is put together. Eddie was more into sports. He would be downstairs, joining in the pickup hallway games with the players' sons, some of whom went on to great heights. How many kids can say that they got to toss a ball around with future superstars like Barry Bonds, Cal Ripken Jr., Roberto Alomar, and Ken Griffey Jr., when they were very young? My Eddie can. The boys were enjoying some unique experiences. I never wanted my sons to feel that they were missing out on anything because of my disability. Perhaps I even overcompensated for it. I tried to take the boys everywhere. I felt the need to do things that any other father would do, even to go to some places that others wouldn't or couldn't. The Lowe's Journal Square Theater in Jersey City, the same place where Dee and I had our very first date, showed special Disney double features on Saturdays in the 1970s. The boys really enjoyed Disney films. When we weren't at the ballpark, I'd take them by bus to the movies. We had a little ritual. We'd stop at Boulevard Drinks, next door to the theater, for a hot dog and limericky lunch, then go to the movies. When the films were done, we'd walk to the Canton Tea Garden, where my parents used to treat my sister and me in the 1940s, for a big Chinese meal. The double feature usually ended with a classic Disney animated film, finished with a modern live-action one like Herbie the Love Bug or the Apple Dumpling Gang. Unlike today, they didn't have 30 minutes of commercials and previews before the movie. The theater used piped-in classical music as a pre-show. The music would end abruptly, the curtain would open, and the film would begin. I generally seat the boys, then head to the lobby for popcorn and candy, getting back just in time for the start of the film. One week, the bill was Fantasia and the Boatniks. We ran late that day, so we took our seats with a few minutes to spare. I went to get the popcorn and rushed back into the theater just after the appointed starting time. I still heard the classical music playing, so I figured I was okay. 10 minutes later, still no movie. I checked my watch. 20 minutes had gone by, and all I heard was classical music. Finally, I leaned over to Chris and said, "When is the movie going to start?" He whispered back, "It already started, Daddy. It's been going on for a while." Nobody told me that Fantasia had been re-released in the 1970s, with certain cuts to shorten the running time. This newly edited version actually removed the little bits of dialogue that existed between the classical music segments. I had no idea what was happening. I'd taken my sons to see a cartoon that essentially amounted to a silent movie for me. Chris was fascinated by magic when he was young. He wanted me to hire a magician at every birthday party, communion breakfast, and lemonade stand opening that he had. I kept a guy named Prince Jasper pretty much on retainer. Jasper was a classic showman, with a requisite tuxedo, doves, linking rings, and fire-eating. Chris idolized him and imitated his every move. I took Chris and Eddie to magic shows all over New York and New Jersey. As a special treat, I even got private backstage lessons from both Harry Blackstone and Doug Henning when they were appearing on Broadway. Eddie was more of an athlete. I decided to take my boys to a dude ranch in upstate New York so they could spend a week enjoying the genuine cowboy experience. Horseback riding was a big selling point for the resort, so we signed up for lessons. This would be the first time on a horse for each of us. There were about 15 other people in the group. Our instructor helped to get us comfortable in the saddle on our individual horses. Mine was named Takyan. The instructor explained that we would all follow him in line slowly down a dirt road, which would eventually branch off into three different trails. They were marked easy, hard, and even the craziest Hollywood stuntman wouldn't attempt this route. When we arrived at the fork, my horse decided to break from the pack and go his own way. Guess which trail he picked? The instructor screamed in horror as he saw Takyan bolt down the dangerous path. I hung on for dear life. Before I knew it, the horse was jumping and ducking, with me trying to follow its body movements. At one point, Takyan was racing down a trail that had low-hanging limbs. Sighted riders might see them and know enough to duck, but I couldn't. I was being repeatedly smacked in the head with tree branches. It was like something out of a Three Stooges movie. Finally, I was able to pull the reins tight enough to get the horse to stop. The others caught up to me, and the owners apologized profusely. Other than a few scratches, I was fine. Eddie and Chris, who had watched my adventure helplessly from atop their horses, came over and said with shrieks of laughter, "That was awesome, Daddy! Do it again!" I declined. My time as a cowboy ended that day. I'd stick to talking about sports instead. In April 1976, Yankee Stadium reopened. The team was home again. Mr. Steinbrenner and the city did an amazing job. I was excited to be attending my 19th straight opening day. The team itself had also gotten a facelift. Former second baseman Billy Martin was now the manager, bringing not just his fiery temperament, but also a link to the great 1950s teams that had been missing. Thurman had developed into a true leader and had the team primed for another dynastic run. Superstar pitcher Catfish Hunter was a big free agent acquisition for George. Sparky Lyle was now the game's dominant closer. Things were looking up in the Bronx. The stadium was jam-packed. American flag bunting ringed the stands, and old-timers from every Yankee championship team were introduced. Mr. Steinbrenner had given me something that I had never had before, a permanent assigned seat in the press box with my name engraved on it. The chorus of voices ridiculing my inclusion in the New York media's inner circle was growing smaller, but they were still there. George was determined to silence them completely. Just before game time, a familiar voice said, "Hey, Eddie, glad to see you. Do you mind if I take that empty seat next to you?" I'd know that voice anywhere. It was the Yankee Clipper himself, Joe DiMaggio. "Not at all, Mr. DiMaggio," I said, as I started to take my radio out of the bag and set up my headsets. Joe inquired, "What are you doing?" I told him that I needed to listen to the game on the radio to be able to follow what was happening. DiMaggio's next remark took me by surprise. "Put those away, kid. I'll do the play-by-play for you." And so he did. For the next 9 innings, I listened with rapt attention as one of the greatest baseball players ever sat next to me calling his team's 11-4 win over the Twins in their newly remodeled home. I've had many surreal moments in my life, but the day that Joltin' Joe became my own private announcer definitely ranks close to the top. Scooter had his own table in the new press dining room. By then, he was an iconic part of the Yankee broadcasts. He was also one of the best-known voices in the country. The rock star Meatloaf featured Phil on its hit single, "Paris by the Dashboard Light." And Scooter was doing commercials for a place called The Money Store that ran on local TV incessantly. Phil was famous beyond the world of baseball. Celebrities from all areas began to flock to Yankee Stadium in the late 1970s. It was, once again, the it place to be. Most of them made a stop to see Mr. Rizzuto as he held court at his little spot in the dining room. Bob Shepard, the Yankees' longtime public address announcer, usually sat with Phil. If Robert Merrill, the legendary Metropolitan Opera singer, happened to be at Yankee Stadium, he would be there, too. Scooter always reserved a seat for me. This gave me the opportunity to break bread with many people whom I admired. Mr. Rizzuto's table was like the couch on The Tonight Show. Former United States Secretary of State Dr. Henry Kissinger and I once spent a half hour in the dining room having a heated debate over the merits of the designated hitter rule. In the middle of our discussion, Dr. Kissinger stopped to ask me if I could speak a little slower because my Jersey City accent was confusing him. I didn't have the heart to tell the Nobel Peace Prize winner that I actually only understood every other word that he was saying in his trademark thick Teutonic tone. Michael Douglas liked the conversation that I was having with him so much that we continued it on the dugout bench after dinner. I sat with the Oscar winner for over an hour talking about his favorite baseball teams and players. He knew what he was talking about. Douglas would have made a great sportcaster. When Billy Joel mentioned to me, between bites, that he was a big fan of Johnny Ray's music, we started quoting lyrics from the former teen idol's greatest hits to each other. I told the piano man about the Victrola I got for my birthday in 1952, and the speech about Johnny Ray that my dad made to me as he presented me with the records. Joel loved hearing that. A few years later, Billy included Johnny in his rapid-fire list of icons on his hit single, "We Didn't Start the Fire." I've always wondered if our dinner conversation had any influence on that. In the 1970s, some of my wardrobe selections were, to say the least, a bit colorful and garish. I wasn't alone. Many players and reporters were clad in the same gooky outfits. As a blind man, I can only say that I had a built-in excuse. I'm not sure what the other guys are using for their defense. One night, the court jester himself, Danny Kaye, stopped by to nosh with Mr. Rizzuto and me. Once he got a good look at my multicolored checkered suit I was wearing, Kaye shouted to nobody in particular, "Does anyone have a good set of earplugs? This boy's jacket is so loud that they can hear it all the way over into Brooklyn." Mr. Rizzuto's best friend, Yogi Berra, was a coach on Billy Martin's 76 ball club. He was the same old Yogi, a baseball lifer. I couldn't imagine him out of a uniform. He and his wife Carmen were also devoted supporters of local charities. Yogi invited me to a benefit golf tournament and dinner at the Montclair Country Club in New Jersey. I accepted, even though I had no idea how to play golf. That was solved by their special guests for the day. Bob Hope was the featured speaker and honoree at Yogi's affair. He was treated like a visiting dignitary. People lined up in the morning to meet the legendary comedian. They all wanted to shake his hand and say hello. Yogi brought me to the front of the line to introduce us. When Hope saw me, he asked me if I'd been golfing that day. I said no, explaining that I'd never been on the links. Hope was astounded. Nobody ever taught you how to play golf. I wanted to tell you, you're missing out on the great game. He then made an interesting suggestion. Let me teach you, Ed. This was another moment that I would add to the surreal category. Before I knew it, Mr. Hope had fetched a set of left-handed golf clubs for me. He stood behind me and taught me how to swing. It was a bit different from a baseball bat. I followed him to the golf course and put my newly learned lessons to use. After a few tries, I connected. I couldn't see where it landed, of course, but Hope let out a cheer that let me know I'd made it to the green. We spent the rest of the afternoon on the links chatting about life, baseball, he was part owner of the Cleveland Indians, and golf. Mr. Hope shared with me how nervous he was the first time that he had learned how to play golf while he was still on New York's vaudeville and burlesque circuit in the 1930s. I didn't want to embarrass myself on the course, he mused. I used to spend all of my free time underneath the 59th Street Bridge, shooting balls into the East River for practice. Bob also told me not to worry about the final tally. Years ago, Bing Crosby told me that my score would equal my height, Hope said with a chuckle as he lined me up for a putt. I usually wind up shooting my weight. He assured me that I'd get better over time with practice. I've been playing this game so long now, Ed, that they write my handicap in Roman numerals. When the day and our lesson was done, Mr. Hope suggested that we take a photo. We were already inside, so somebody set up a makeshift tee on a platform and snapped the shot. My guide, Angelo, crouched behind me. It's one of my favorite pictures. I saw my Hollywood golf teacher a few times after that at the stadium. He never failed to ask, "How's your swing, Ed?" A few days after the event, I ran into Yogi in the Yankee locker room. He asked how I enjoyed the day at his outing. I told him all about my golf lessons. Yogi said, "No kidding. You can golf now? Maybe you and me should get out there and play each other." I answered, "Great, Yogi. I'd love to. When and where do you suggest?" Yogi thought about it for a minute and proposed the Montclair Country Club on the following Monday, which was an off day for the team. "What time do you want me to meet you, Yogi?" I asked innocently. "I don't know," he said. "Anytime you want to play, I'm ready." I smiled and answered, "Okay, let's play at midnight." Yogi was indignant. He shouted, "Midnight? There's no light on the course at midnight. I won't be able to see a thing." "Well," I said dryly, "that will make us even, won't it?" The ballpark was a fun place to hang out and work, but I still wasn't selling many stories. The Yankees were getting better, and I'd earned the respect of players. But I needed that one big interview to get the attention of station managers and editors. That breakthrough came on a cold Sunday afternoon at the end of the season. The Yankees were on the path to their first postseason appearance in over a decade when the hapless Tigers came into town on September 12, 1976. The biggest story for them that year was their rookie sensation, pitcher Mark Fidrich. Because of his height, long curly blonde hair, and quirky habits on the mound, Fidrich had been dubbed the Bird, after Big Bird of Sesame Street fame. Earlier in the year, he beat the Yankees in Detroit on a Monday night baseball game that set ratings records. The whole country was in love with him and his story. By September, Mark was completely burned out and overwhelmed by the media attention. A gentle soul, he preferred anonymity instead of the microscope that he was under. Since New York was and is the media center, everyone wanted a piece of him. Reporters followed him everywhere. Fidrich decided that he didn't want to answer the same questions over and over again. He wanted to find one reporter whom he could trust to come up with a fair line of inquiry, one who wouldn't try to dig up dirt or push him to talk trash. I asked Mark for a little bit of his time, and he granted it. I was the one he chose. Perhaps it was because Fidrich saw that I had the respect of his manager, Ralph Houck, who had been the skipper of the Yankees in the early 1960s. Maybe the bird watched me joking around on the field before the game with Thurman Munson, who was similarly press-shot. Whatever the reason, the wonderkind pitcher spoke to me for over 15 minutes, while he dismissed almost everyone else. I didn't realize that Mark was giving me a somewhat exclusive interview until I got up to my seat in the press box. Several of my peers began asking me to play the interview for them. I suddenly understood the value of what was on my tape. I could have sold the contents to any number of radio stations for quite a price. That went against my ethics. In the interest of professional courtesy and fairness, I allowed anyone who wished to freely take quotes and snippets from the interview to do so. I imposed one condition. They were not allowed to twist the words in any way that would smear Fidrich. They all agreed. Mr. Rizzuto noticed and praised me for my teamwork. That was all the compensation I needed. This free distribution of something in limited supply might seem like stupidity or acting against my own financial interests. The opposite actually happened. Within days of the interview, my phone began ringing with offers to submit stories and interviews about and with the Yankees to radio stations, newspapers, and magazines all over the United States. I was suddenly in demand. I'd been praying for years for this moment to arrive, waiting on God's timing. It was finally here. I thanked him for the opportunity and lessons he'd given me, the people that he allowed me to meet along the way, and the ability to laugh through any adversity. All of these gifts had prepared me for the next moves, onward and upward.